Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Running.
Absolute genius.
Get this.
Welcome.
This is the show where we bring you
science.
What that essentially means is
discoveries,
advances,
questions,
research,
technology.
Unbelievable.
Without further ado,
this is The Naked Scientists. Hello, welcome to The Naked Scientists, the program where we strive to bring you the latest breakthroughs in science, technology, and medicine. I'm Chris Smith. And this week, the spike in whooping cough cases that's occurring across Europe, but what's behind it? Also, how scientists are set to look for life on an icy moon of Jupiter, and the new artificially intelligent gadget to make roads safer for cyclists.
From Cambridge University's Institute of Continuing Education, this is The Naked Scientists.
Europe is facing its worst outbreak of whooping cough in a decade. Cases of the contagious infection, which is also known as pertussis, have been particularly acute in the Czech Republic, which has recorded its highest number of cases since the 1960s. The UK is also seeing an uptick in cases. But why is this? Adam Finn is Professor of Paediatrics at Bristol Medical School.
So this bug, a bacterium that lives in people's noses and mouths and throats, and it passes itself around between people by making them cough. It's quite common in the population. People who get a persistent cough that goes on for 2 or 3 months often are infected with this bug. But the reason we really, really care about it is that very young children, particularly in the first few weeks of life, they get desperately ill, and indeed many of them die. So it's a very serious infection in very young children.
Do we know why it's so nasty?
It's so nasty because it makes a combination of toxic proteins that are very effective at making you cough. And it does that in order to pass itself around. But that is disastrous when it affects the respiratory tract, the lungs and the nose and throat of a very small baby, because it makes it almost impossible for them to breathe. And they end up without enough oxygen. They end up with pneumonia, with infection in their lungs, which can permanently damage the lungs. And they end up with brain damage. And even other organs of the body can be damaged as well. So that's why it's such a nasty bug. It has this combination of factors that make these babies so desperately ill.
We do have a vaccine program, thankfully, though, don't we? Is that effective?
We do indeed, and this vaccine program began a long time ago in the 1950s, at which time we used to have big epidemics of whooping cough about every 3 years, with many hundreds of children dying and thousands of children affected. The problem seemed to have gone away. Unfortunately, what's turned out is that the vaccines that we currently use don't provide lifelong protection. So they protect the babies once they're vaccinated, but that protection doesn't last forever. And so they can get the infection later on in life when they're adolescents, when they're young adults. And that in turn means that they can infect their children, and young babies who've not yet been vaccinated can still get sick.
So you succumb again to infection, but are you as desperately ill as you would have been were you not vaccinated?
We can't actually start vaccinating children until they're 2 months old. They need 3 doses of vaccines at 2, 3, and 4 months. So they're not really fully protected until they're 5 or 6 months old. And that means you've still got this vulnerable period very early on in life. And if the bacterium is still circulating amongst adults, then these babies are still going to get infected. So the way to solve that problem is to protect them from the time of birth. And the way we do that is by immunizing the mothers with a vaccine when they're pregnant.
And how effective is this? So are adults succumbing to pertussis or whooping cough infection without realising it? So we've got the thing going through the population, but because they've been vaccinated earlier in life, they're getting a less severe infection and might not realise it.
That's right. I mean, whooping cough, even in an unvaccinated adult, is a nuisance. It makes you cough for a long time. You wouldn't like it. And you'll be feeling rotten with it for a while. But it won't kill you, and you'll recover. So that's right. People perhaps don't realize they've got a whooping cough. They've got a persistent cough, and they don't recognize what it is. But if they're in contact with small children, then that's when the disaster occurs. We don't at the moment have vaccines that are capable of eliminating the circulation of the bacterium altogether. We just don't have them. So the only way we can solve the problem in the young children is by immunizing them, and even more than that, by immunizing their mothers before they're born.
We're seeing a big uptick in cases, though. In some countries, we've seen it go from a few tens of cases in a month to literally thousands of cases in a month. We're seeing an uptick here as well. Why do you think the numbers are suddenly climbing?
The main reason right now is that, like many other infectious diseases, during the COVID pandemic, when everybody was not in contact with each other, whooping cough went away. So there was nobody getting whooping cough. It's a very good way of preventing infections, is just keeping people apart from each other. But of course, once we go back to normal life as we are now, then those infections come surging back. And that's what's happening with whooping cough at the moment. But the other reason for it is that whooping cough has always been an illness that comes in waves. So we have a period when there are lots of cases, and then more people get immune because they've had the infection or been vaccinated, and it goes back down again. So we're seeing one of those waves now, but it's going to be bigger and stronger because of this absence of circulation and lack of immunity that built up during the period of the COVID pandemic.
And vaccine uptake rates, have they been dented as well? Because we've seen that with, for instance, measles, which is also rearing its ugly head in our country.
Yes, unfortunately, vaccine coverage rates in this country, all of the vaccines, are gradually sinking down. And I think that's due to the underinvestment in the NHS. So there's been less resources to make these programs work well. And to some degree, you know, people are losing their faith in vaccines and perhaps having doubts about the benefits and the importance of getting themselves and their children vaccinated. So we are seeing falling rates of vaccination. And of course, that makes the situation much more dangerous.
So if a person runs into the infection, they take a trip to one of these European countries where they're seeing a big surge, or they know they've had contact with it, what should a person do and how do we treat it?
The only way to avoid whooping cough is to avoid being exposed to people with a cough or be vaccinated. We don't currently vaccinate adults routinely unless they are pregnant women. So the really important things that we need to do at the moment is to make sure that pregnant women are aware of this program, aware of the importance of it for them and their baby, and to inform all parents that they need to get their children immunized against whooping cough with the routine schedule. And if they've missed any doses, they need to get in touch with their GP and get the baby or the child immunized up to date straight away.
Adam Finn from Bristol Medical School. Later this year, a new chapter in the search for extraterrestrial life begins when NASA's Europa Clipper space probe sets off for the icy moon of Jupiter that shares its name. It'll be armed with instruments to confirm whether, as scientists suspect, there's a vast ocean beneath the icy crust of the moon, and whether plumes of water that periodically issue from the surface of the moon contain biological material. Fabian Klenner at the University of Washington is one of the scientists testing the tools that will be on the lookout for an historic landmark in space science, and I've been speaking to him.
Around two decades ago, it turned out that there are moons around Saturn and Jupiter that have liquid water. The water is not on the surface as we know it from Earth, but it's on the subsurface under thick ice crusts covering these moons. Life on Earth, as we know it, requires liquid water. We also need enough energy and interesting chemistry, chemical reactions ongoing. And all these ingredients appear to be present on these moons, in particular on Enceladus, a moon of Saturn, and Europa, a moon of Jupiter.
And what keeps the water liquid? Given it's got that huge, thick, icy crust, it's very, very cold there. It's a massive distance away from the sun. We measure the distance in millions of kilometres, don't we? Hundreds of millions of kilometres. So why is it liquid at all?
These moons orbit their host planet not in a perfect circular orbit. At some point, they are closer to the planet, and sometimes they are not so close to the planet. And these variations in gravitational forces lead to a lot of heat production in the interior of the moons, and this is enough energy to maintain liquid water.
So they get sort of stretched and squeezed as they go around. If there is life there and it's under hugely thick ice crusts, how can we find it at all?
We can send instruments there. There will be the Europa Clipper spacecraft set for launch in October this year. And there will be one instrument on board the spacecraft that's a so-called mass spectrometer that measures ice grains that are ejected from Europa, so that are either knocked off the surface of the moon or maybe even emitted in a geyser. And if there is a mechanism, we don't know that, but if there is life at all, to bring that life into these ice grains, then we have very good chances to use such kind of instruments to figure out if there is life or not, because the life would be entrapped.
And the thrust of this project was to ask, well, what's the hallmarks of life in those ice grains if it's there?
Yes. So we did experiments in the laboratory to simulate what these instruments in space should actually deliver. To simulate this process, we used a tiny liquid water beam and injected that into a vacuum. And this liquid water beam disintegrates into droplets. And we prepared this water in a way that we added bacterial cells to our samples so that, in theory, one cell is in one of these water droplets. And then we were shooting with a laser onto these water droplets to simulate the process of measuring single ice grains with these mass spectrometers in space.
What sort of range of types of cells and cell chemistries and organizations can you see? Because we're assuming, of course, that life is going to pop up in these oceans and look very similar to what life does look like on Earth, but that may not be the case at all, mightn't it? So do you think you're geared up in order to detect a range of different forms of life, regardless of what it looks like?
So I always like to argue that there is plenty of liquid water on these moons. There is plenty of energy. There is organic chemistry. So the same ingredients are there. And I personally think it is not a bad approach to look for life as we know it on an ocean moon like Enceladus or Europa. And so this is why we were focusing on bacterial cells that we know from Earth. And we were particularly looking at cell culture that likes cold environments, that is very small, so that could fit into these ice grains. And also the same culture likes only low nutrient fluxes.
A good friend of mine, John Czarnecki, built the Huygens lander, or helped to build the Huygens lander that landed on Titan, Saturn's largest moon. And I remember him saying, this will take 7 years to get from launch to there. And he said, it's a long time to wait to find out whether or not you've succeeded. How long are you going to have to wait?
I probably have to wait about 6 years, maybe 6.5. So Europa Clipper should arrive in the Jupiter system in 2030. And then hopefully return data very, very soon.
And hopefully you've got some other projects to work on in the meantime. Otherwise, you could be a very, very quiet scientist for the next 6 years.
I definitely won't be very quiet. There's plenty of work to do and plenty of things to prepare for Europa Clipper and also other hopefully upcoming missions.
We wish you luck, Fabian. Fabian Klenner there from the University of Washington.
The Naked Scientists podcast is produced in association with Spitfire, cost-effective voice, internet and IP engineering services for UK businesses. Find out how Spitfire can empower your company at spitfire.co.uk.
Music in the programme is sponsored by Epidemic Sound, perfect music for audio and video productions.
You're listening to The Naked Scientists with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, how AI-powered bike lights are helping to keep cyclists safe. But first, researchers presented some preliminary data at a conference in Spain this week showing how they've successfully used the Nobel Prize-winning gene editing tool called CRISPR to eliminate human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV, from infected cells in culture. HIV is problematic to cure because it inserts covert copies of its genetic code inside our own human DNA. And it's from these hidden viruses that lurk off of our immune radars that HIV stages a comeback whenever infected patients stop taking their medication. So editing out these viruses is a step closer to ridding the body of infection. The BBC's digital health editor, Michelle Roberts, told me more.
They've used this technology that has been around for a few years now. It won a Nobel Prize back in 2020. And if you look at cells on the molecular level, it's like a little pair of scissors that can snip out bits of DNA. It's called gene editing. It's CRISPR is the actual technology we're talking about. Those little scissors can go in and start changing things within the cell. And hopefully that could be really helpful because with HIV, we know that this virus gets into cells, it hijacks them and starts using the cell's own machinery to make more copies of the virus. At the moment, we've got really powerful HIV drugs that people can take that can keep it at bay, but it can't get rid of it entirely. So there's still some HIV within the body.
And the argument is if you've got a mechanism for gene editing, you could go into the cells that are harbouring that genetic message and disable the genetic message, thereby disabling the infection.
Exactly. So you either entirely snip out a bit of the HIV genetic code, the blueprint, or you just disable it so it can't do it very well anymore. They're saying that this is very early work. So at the moment, they've been looking at cells in the lab, but another company has actually started trying to do it in a few people as well. But you also need to look at safety and whether it will work well enough, because we've already got really good treatments for HIV.
Indeed, because about 20 years ago, if you'd come up with this, people would have said, let's give it a go. I've got nothing to lose. But now we have a situation where a person with HIV, adequately treated, has got the same life expectancy as someone without HIV. So you're sort of saying to someone who's healthy, have a potentially risky procedure, which might not be attractive to them.
Yeah, it's still uncharted waters. I mean, people have been using this CRISPR, these little molecular scissors, if you like, for other things too, because you can see how if you can tinker with DNA and correct some things that are going wrong, you could treat lots of different things. They have been using it for some types of sight loss, genetic sight loss. They've looked at it for sickle cell disease, various things. And there are some early promising findings, but then also researchers are really monitoring what are the side effects, because you might get some slight off-target editing and that could cause other issues that might not be apparent at the moment.
What do we think the risk of that happening is? If it's good enough to go into people already, presumably scientists think they've got a pretty good handle on how good and how accurate this set of molecular scissors can be made to be. So how risky is it?
It's really difficult at the moment to put a number, or if you had a patient in front of you, it would be really hard to say, well, 1 in 10 people have no side effects, or, you know, some sort of tangible risk. The other difficulty with this type of technology is we're talking about such minute level that you've got to get this way of editing into the cell. And they've found that this CRISPR technology, the packaging you need to get it into the cell, is quite bulky. So these researchers at the moment who've been looking at HIV have been trying to find different methods of getting that size of the package down small and small and smaller to get it into the cell efficiently.
And what about other viruses beyond just HIV? Because I think I read a few years ago, people were saying when you catch one of the herpes viruses like chickenpox and get shingles because it keeps coming back, or herpes simplex that causes cold sores because it keeps coming back from your nervous system. If we could do this sort of gene editing, you could disable that virus wherever it's resident in the body, and then you wouldn't suffer painful blisters periodically.
I mean, that would make sense, that there are lots of different infections that can lay dormant for a while, but can then reemerge and cause problems. It would make sense if you can find the right genetic code, you can deliver this package that can get into the cell and start changing that DNA or disabling some of it without causing any side effects. That's the massive question mark here. You know, we need to be sure that these treatments are safe enough, because even with sort of chickenpox and other things that can reactivate, we do have other treatments out there.
And when you spoke to the team, were they confident they're going to be able to crack this nut? Or are they saying, look, this is promising, but it's so far off into the future, don't hold your breath?
They're very excited, but it's certainly not going to be tomorrow. And they were quite open about that. They were saying, you know, we really don't want to suggest that we've got a cure round the corner. It's not that, but it is exciting science. And given that lots of people are exploring different diseases with this CRISPR technology, it's definitely one to keep watching and pushing on.
That was the BBC's digital health editor, Michelle Roberts. Over 10,000 cyclists are injured and more than 100 killed each year on Britain's roads. Often it's because approaching vehicles don't see them and the cyclists only find out too late that they need to take evasive action. So can AI help? A device called Copilot, which is an AI-powered bike light that uses smart sensors to constantly watch the road and the movement of vehicles, forewarns road users and cyclists of potentially dangerous situations that are about to happen using audio cues. The founder and CEO of Velo.ai, Clark Haynes, has been telling me how it works.
It's bringing a lot of the advanced tech that you find in things like the modern automobile and really bringing it to bear for safety for the cyclist. Right now, it's about the size, a little bit larger than a deck of cards. It's small enough that it tucks just right under your seat. It's rearward looking, so it's watching out for vehicles behind you. And it's battery powered, so it'll last for about 5 hours off of its internal battery. So you can just go for a ride and you're all set.
That's still pretty small to have the power of an artificial intelligence system scanning a road for you. What's it doing? Is it using cameras then to watch what's coming up behind?
Exactly. There are existing competitive products out there that use radar sensors. And we just looked for cameras as a better way of understanding the world. And you can do so much more with a better sensor. So the device itself is primarily composed of a camera that's watching the world, a set of lights that can react to things in the world like other drivers, audio that can be used to cue the bicyclist, and then onboard compute, a Raspberry Pi made right in the UK, paired with a special AI chip. And that's what really allows us to do all of this computer vision image processing in real time on really, really low power budget so that we can run off of batteries.
What does the AI do with the camera pictures? And then what's the output from the device to warn the cyclist?
It's watching the world. It's understanding the world from the perspective of the bicyclist. And it's able to essentially detect approaching vehicles and understand what they're doing and what their behavior is. I've actually been spending my career strapping cameras to robots and autonomous vehicles. So a lot of the opportunity here was to bring some of that intelligence to the world of cycling.
So if you're in danger of being rear-ended, or what they dub in the industry a SMIDSEE, sorry mate, I didn't see you, then this should be able to anticipate those sorts of things that claim the lives of or cause injuries to cyclists and then warn them.
Exactly. That's our goal. And it's a warning to the cyclist, but then it's also a warning to the driver. The design is that a few seconds before that, you're going after something more like a startle reflex, because we can have reactive light patterns that change and try to get the attention of a potentially distracted driver.
Have you road tested it? Do you know if it does give people enough warning to make a reasonable difference that will avoid an accident or improve the safety for cyclists?
Yeah, absolutely. We've been road testing for almost a year and a half with earlier beta versions and now with our production version out with the public. And right now these are all over the US, but also a natural focus in our home city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which is a challenging city with lots of difficult roads, full of potholes, hills, weather, you know, bad drivers too, all of those things. The feedback we get from our users is that, yes, drivers are giving me more space and I feel safer and more confident biking on these roads because I know what's going on behind me. And that's really the goal of what we're doing. We actually just built a rig that's going to allow us to really accurately measure some of these outcomes. And we intend to publish the results of that in the coming months.
How do you see the approach and the technology going forward? Could this be deployed in different ways, different vehicles, different contexts, or are you going to develop this just for the cycle market more? And if so, what will you add?
Yeah, that's a great question. The biggest thing for us with cycling is that you have such a passionate set of users and a community that's focused on safety. Because, you know, every cyclist is riding on the roads and they're wishing, hey, I just want to come home safe. And so I think it's a great place to start. That being said, you know, we find all sorts of mobility are taking hold in our cities, particularly this kind of personal micromobility. So this is bikes, but this is also scooters and one wheels and all of these new contraptions. We see this really coming to bear across all forms of personal micromobility.
Clark Haynes there. Well, it's time now for our question of the week, which is sponsored by Clam XAV, the anti-malware software that protects your Mac without compromising its performance. Tried and tested by us, Clam XAV provides top quality malware and virus protection for your Mac that won't slow down your computer. And even better, listeners to The Naked Scientist can get 20% off their first year using the code NAKED20. You go to clamxav.com/naked and use that discount code NAKED20 to protect your Mac today. Now, what is II times IV? We're about to find out in our question of the week, which Will Tingle's been looking into for listener Dana in Queensland, who wrote to ask how the Romans did multiplications using their numeral system of numbers.
It's a great question, Dana. The Romans were, of course, great engineers, and there has been considerable recent interest in Vitruvius and the architectural wonders that he and his colleagues helped build in ancient Rome. But how on earth did these early engineering pioneers work out the maths required using Roman numerals? In a bid to answer it, we put in a call to Ems Lord, director of the University of Cambridge's Mathematics Outreach Programme.
If we think about how we multiply today, that can be really helpful in answering this question. Because today there's a lot of different multiplication methods, and they often vary according to where you are, which way you were taught. So it could be, with the Roman Empire being so vast, there's not one definitive answer, but it is likely that they used a method of doubling and halving. And just to give you an example of how it works, let's suppose we wanted to multiply 37 and 39. So with 37 multiplied by 39, doubling and halving would give us 18 multiplied by 78, ignoring the odds. Do it again, we get 9 multiplied by 156. So we need to do it again. 4 times 312, nearly there. Then 2 times 624. And finally, 1 multiplied by 1,248. So we stop there, and then we cast out any of those pairs of numbers which are both even. Totaling the rest of one side gives us 1,443. Now, it might seem a very complex way of doing things to us, but actually, maybe it appears tricky because we're not used to doing it. It's not our everyday approach. We haven't developed that fluency which they might have had from doing that type of calculation more often.
It's devilishly simple and very effective, and it seems to work pretty well for them. They got quite large, as I remember.
Yeah, and if they did use this method, I suspect that they would have used their Roman numerals as, say, you had the number 4, so we'd have 1111, as opposed to the way we often write it today, which would be a 1V, 5 minus 1, because it's much easier to halve those 4 ones than trying to halve 1V. So, you know, perhaps it was easier than we thought doing that multiplication in their day. But again, key thing is getting the correct answer rather than having a prescribed method. And certainly the Romans could perform great feats of engineering. So their methods worked.
So there you have it. A pity for them that their empire ended up halving more than it doubled. Thank you to Dana for the question and to Ems Lord for the answer. Next week, we're answering this question sent in from listener Paris, who asks, why are babies so strong? Seriously, their grip is actually ridiculous. Well, we'll get our hands on that one next week.
Thanks very much to Will Tingle. And if you've got a question you'd like us to get our teeth into, do send it in. It's chris@thenakedscientist.com, and we will see what we can do. Well, that's all we have time for this week. Do be sure to tune in on Tuesday, though, when Alzheimer's disease and the science behind helping to tackle it is what's going to be going under our microscope. The Naked Scientist comes to you from the University of Cambridge's Institute of Continuing Education. It is supported by Rolls-Royce. I'm Chris Smith. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.